Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Welcome back to the property planner, buyer and professor. It's my pleasure to be talking today about some of our learnings, and it's a part B segment, and it's a listener question that we've loved addressing in detail. But before we start, it's been joyous to chat to both of you about our love affair with our city in the midst of everything that we've been through over the last 18 months. And I even let you chat a little bit about AFL football, Dave, because your point was beautiful. We've got a very vibrant city that it feels like we're getting closer to reopening and enjoying all of those wonderful things again, the arts, the sporting precincts, the events, the restaurants. So, and Pete, it's been great to share some of that with you too, because you're a regular visitor to our city.
Yeah, so what if we could let our listeners into how this all started. You were saying that a lot of the houses that you're going to, the sales, are due to divorces or people moving interstate, so leaving Melbourne but going interstate. But we also talked about how through these lockdowns we've really appreciated what we do have. You know, whether you live in Melbourne or Adelaide or some other capital city, you know, the fact that you can't go out to your favourite cafe or restaurant or to your gym or to a sporting event or to an art show really makes you appreciate it when those restrictions will be lifted much sooner than later. We're only weeks away from that happening.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The memories have become really sweet of the times that we did have, and I think we'll cherish those and appreciate it for all that it represents when we are back on stream. And it's also forced us to focus on things very close to home when we have had a little bit of freedom, particularly for Victorians. You know, my love affair with our regions is burnt even brighter because of weekend away, you know, in a place like Bendigo or Castlemaine or wherever. They're really special. And instead of just getting a ticket to go overseas and getting the passport ready, we've been forced to explore our local regions. And I think that's been one, you know, really positive facet to what's ordinarily been a pretty difficult time.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, we've been forced to further explore our local 5 kilometre radius. And so, you know, we've got to know more parks and places to go for kids and more walking tracks and trails and creeks and rivers. So there's been a lot of upside, as well as really appreciating all the things that we're missing out on that, you know, when you're getting access to all the things that you mentioned there, Pete, all year round, you can to some degree at times take it a little bit for granted. As I was saying to you guys, I've just been reflecting in the last month how much I really do enjoy living in Melbourne, obviously when it's opened up.
Yeah.
all the things we have at our fingertips.
Yeah, very true.
So what's your market update, Pete?
Well, the CoreLogic data came out very recently, their monthly chart pack. And what was of real interest to me was the investor lending. From early 2017, investor lending started to drop away. And some people might say it's a coincidence. I don't say it's a coincidence. I say it's a cause. Investor lending drops away. Therefore, less investors are buying rental property. Less rental properties, rents go up, vacancy rates go down. The reason I mention that is because a lot of people are screaming that, well, a lot of investors are very happy that the rents are going up and property prices are going up. If we look at the wider community, when international borders open and we have hundreds of thousands of families come over, where are all these people going to live?
Yeah.
If the vacancy rate's already so tight. So if anyone in government's listening, keeping in mind that supply is quite inelastic, in other words, you can't just click your fingers and you'll have an extra 1,000 or 10,000 properties. We need to consider how we're going to increase the supply of housing to cater for the huge influx of migrants that we are going to have in the next several years.
Absolutely. It's a really good one, Pete. I've been thinking about the same thing. They really need to encourage new stock coming online, and that takes time, doesn't it? With the vacancy rate so low, they're stuck between a rock and a hard place, particularly if they're trying to slow down the investor numbers as well, potentially with what APRA's done with increasing the benchmark assessment rate for lending.
Yeah, so since 2017, when APRA doubled the deposit requirements for investors compared to owner-occupiers and increased the interest rate, less investors are in the market. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to work out what's going to happen.
Yeah.
It takes a while. It doesn't happen overnight, but it certainly happened now.
Interesting that you open this Pandora's box, and I've been noting the same thoughts, Pete, and I think that we will see APRA get creative with how they cap people going out and stretching and spending. We have to manage how we cap investor activity really effectively. And what we did, and you alluded to it, in 17, 18, 19, it ground to a halt because it just got so hard for investors to get their hands on money, even really strong income investors, particularly those who had multiple assets and multiple debts, because the heightened assessment rate ran across all of their debts. And my prediction is that we're going to see a change in policy that's different to what we saw in that period of time, where the assessment with the heightened buffer rate might only apply to the asset that you're buying. And we might see lenders being prepared to look at existing debt and keep it counted as an existing debt without applying heightened buffers. And I think that's yet to come, because we'll create a massive issue for ourselves if we chase away investors like we did during that period.
Yeah,
agreed.
We might have a whole episode here, I think, because there's a fair bit to unpack in these points. Yeah. I actually think, just quickly, a little prediction, having thought about it a bit, I don't think this APRA intervention is going to have much impact. I think
neither, because
they're going
we
to
came
have
down
to do something else.
And I've said to a few people who have asked, and, you know, it's a scary headline if you don't understand the mechanics behind it. When we did see credit loosen, we came off as 7.65 and in some cases even higher servicing rates, right down to early fives. And that was a really significant jump. It was almost 2.5%. Now we're talking about 0.5%. So the position that it's going to throw us back into is not going to be the same as 2019.
And the banks were much more wary of lending then because of going through the Banking Royal Commission. And that had a huge impact on banks' willingness to lend. They were very fearful during that period of time. And, you know, that was over and above anything APRA did.
Yeah.
Is that your market update, Kate?
No. I'll be really quick with mine. That's right. I think I snuck the same slide pack as Pete was referring to. And, you know, we talk about CoreLogic a lot. There are a lot of really great portals, but we get some really great data out of CoreLogic, and they have a website that people can subscribe to and get some of these reports. You don't have to be necessarily a paid user. And one that really sparked my attention was a recent report on the parity between median house price and median unit price per suburb. And it spans right across the nation. And what's really interesting is we can see what the parity was as a percentage. So the percentage value of a unit as opposed to a house in the same suburb back in 2016 and now. So we've got a five-year differential, and that tells a story. We've got some suburbs in our nation where unit prices are representative of less than a quarter of the house price in that given suburb. Now, some suburbs, you can pick that. You might go to, you know, one of our Stonington suburbs here in Melbourne, where you've got mansions and then one-bedroom units. But you can see a differential playing out, particularly over the five-year period. And what that says to me is an emerging opportunity for buyers who could look at units, because it is an elastic model. I remember years ago writing a blog about the ratio that I consider is a healthy balance between villa units and house prices. And when you can tell that there's an opportunity or a sweet spot for advantageous purchasing in a given area, because that ratio starts to adjust. And this is a really great measure, and I recommend anyone who's keen to understand a bit more about the buying opportunity for the unit market, they get their hands on this report.
That's
we'd really pump up CoreLogic, don't we? They should be sponsoring us. Hang on, no, we don't. We don't take any sponsors. We're independent here. We don't do any commercials here. No.
Well, they're pretty independent data providers, so maybe we could accept a sponsorship from them. That's a great one, Kate. When you look back over the data of the long-term capital growth rates of the older style apartments, they're very much in line with the capital growth rates of quality standalone homes over the long term. They've obviously taken a hit over the probably the last 10 years.
It has been the last 10 years. I recall, you know, a lot of Eastern buyers agents 15 years ago, they were just taking a budget and plucking a unit off the shelf in Hawthorne or wherever, you know, the leafy suburbs. You know, you can't dare cross the city and go west or go north. You've got to just stick to the leafy east. And, you know, that didn't play out well for a lot of investors because we saw an enormous rate of gentrification in the closer parts of our city where people who want to buy something for a longer term tenure and raise their family were voting with their feet. And so we saw an outperformance of older style houses in the inner north and inner west that at one stage were priced similarly to units in the east. And that's definitely thrown a lot of people. But I don't think that we should necessarily shun the older style units. And I'm not just talking apartments, and apartments have their own challenges, but certainly villa units and older style townhouses, they deserve a look.
Yeah, absolutely. That could be a whole episode on its own too, I think. So my market update, as you know, I like to look at the big picture. And I also like to look at get information that's provided by organisations or people who seem to not have vested interests or at least be independent from, in this case, the politics of Australia, hopefully. So in the last week, the International Monetary Fund put out a paper, if you like, on who's in pole position to make the most of the transition away from fossil fuels. And they actually had Australia as number one. And I think this sort of interconnects with our episode 106 on Australia-China relations and what is the risk to the Australian housing market. So basically they said Australia is in pole position to benefit from a sixfold increase in demand for the so-called critical minerals worth $17.6 trillion over the next two decades in Aussie dollars. So this is obviously driven by the race to hit net zero emissions. So they specifically selected nickel, copper, lithium and cobalt as the top four energy transition metals likely to see surges in prices and production as the world works towards the net zero by 2050 if the National Party can come to some sort of agreement with the Liberals. So, you know, these four minerals are the key components in batteries and renewable energies that are crucial in the transition from fossil fuels. So why are we likely to be number one? Australia already has among the top three global reserves for each of the three of the four critical minerals. So that's why they believe we're in prime position to benefit from the new electricity storage and generation shift. They did warn, however, there was a high degree of uncertainty around trying to predict demand scenarios and the pace of technological change and also policy uncertainty, which is obviously happening right now and has been for the best part of the last decade. I think it just highlights how we can potentially pivot again. We went from wool to coal to iron ore, and we've certainly got an opportunity over the next couple of decades to transition away to another key area of export income once more.
That's insightful, Dave.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
Well, this particular episode, as I said, is part B. We had a listener ask us to share any hints or tips that we've learnt along the way. And we separated it into two bits. And as our listeners are beginning to notice, we love to go into detail. And so we can take one question and span a few episodes. And we love doing that. Last week, we talked about the more strategic and planning related tips that we wanted to share. And this time we're chatting about location, suburbs, you know, the selection part of things. And I would love to also talk about some of the tactics, you know, from negotiating and every single part of the process, even down to, you know, settling the property, some of the tips that I can share through my learnings as well. So what we're going to talk about, we'll start with macro location. You know, what are some of the hints and tips that we've learned along the way? Pete, can I ask you to open up?
What I did is I got my spreadsheet out. So some people might remember that I wrote a book back in 2008 on the best suburbs to invest in Australia. And then in 2018, I went back to see how good or bad my predictions were. And I just want to highlight a few things. So the point I'm trying to make here is one of your first steps is to work out which state or city you're going to invest in, because it can make a huge difference. I'll admit, I reckon I'm pretty good at picking suburbs, but I'm also pretty hopeless at picking the right city to invest in, as Dave could attest to, because both Dave and I said that Perth would be top of the charts this year so far as growth is concerned, but we certainly got that totally wrong.
Well, don't feel bad. I think I said Melbourne, right?
So in that 10-year period, what I did was I picked a list of 20 suburbs that I thought were going to perform better than most others, all right? So in Sydney, in that 10-year period, all my 20 suburbs at least doubled in value, and the best performing one was Chippendale. So Chippendale was 156% increase. But when I go to Adelaide and I look at my best performing suburb, it was Kensington at 57%. In Brisbane, it was Sandgate at 59%. Canberra, Narrabundra at 59%. Darwin, Rapid Creek at 50%. Melbourne was pretty good. Melbourne was Braybrook at 149%. But the point I'm trying to make is, especially for those other capital cities, Adelaide, Brisbane, Canberra and Darwin, even the best performing of my list was nowhere near the worst performing in Sydney, which was the best performing capital city. So I think it's very important, because you can't change location. That's why micro and macro location are so important. The first step is you got to work out which city do you think is going to do the best for your time frame, whether you're thinking of holding it for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, whatever it might be. Actually, the longer you hold it, probably the less important it is, because there will be different cycles. We've talked on the show last week and the week before how one decade Sydney was the best performing capital city, but then the next decade it was the worst performing capital city. And same for Melbourne. It was the second worst one decade, second best another decade. So the longer you leave it, the less important it is. But still, you need to take which city you're going to invest in seriously, because, as I said, you cannot change location.
Really good point, Pete. The power of time.
Yes, we're all geniuses in hindsight. If I knew what I know now, yes.
As soon as you're trying to time the market or make a short gain, it becomes a really difficult exercise. And I chatted to a young couple last night who, you know, like a lot of people are, asking me for hotspots. Oh, what about this one? And what about this? And what about if we put our money into this? And I said, just hang on a second. You're 27. Yeah. You just need to pick something good and stick with it. And you need to get your skates on. Do it sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and that's why we work through these step-by-step considerations, isn't it, to help people get their strategy right and not bounce around like a pinball in a pinball machine,
yeah,
you know, jumping from this thought to that thought to this thought. You know, actually have a bit of a structure to how you work through it. In terms of macro location, you know, we like our clients to own at least one property, ideally in Melbourne or Sydney. I think if you go back and look over the data for the last 3 to 4 decades, Melbourne and Sydney have outperformed the other capital cities. And that can make a reasonable difference over a long period of time. So that certainly is one of the key considerations we would look at with every individual when it comes to choosing the macro location. Also, if they plan to purchase a future home, does it make sense for them to try and purchase the investment property in and around where they'd like to own a future home within, so they can ensure they're tracking with the growth rate of where they'd like to get into for a home down the track, which is often going to be more expensive than the investment property as well. So there's some of the factors we would get them to consider. I touched on a number of them in my gold nugget last week as well. So in terms of where do they own properties already, considering diversification, are there any land tax considerations whereby they own a lot of property in one state and therefore it's really starting to eat into their yield? So would they want to consider looking at another state? But perhaps the most important is, what is their price range and what does that allow them to buy within that capital city in particular? If your budget's too low that you're going to be overly compromised and can't get a quality property in City A or City B, let's say, for example, Melbourne and Sydney, well, maybe you do need to look at another capital city because of your budget. So aligning your budget with the city, the macro location also is very important.
Yeah, great point, Dave. And a tip that I like to apply is understanding, just having a really broad look at median house and unit values, not just in a capital city. We need to throw regions into the mix. And I think diversification is very important. I've got interstate properties and I've got regional properties. And I think to get that balance, if you know what you're doing and you're targeting different cities, then you're already introducing diversification. But just having a look at the median values and comparing that to your budget is a really good first step. And I think that's a very easy tip for anyone to employ.
Yeah, and it's a very worthwhile one that everyone should look at. How does their budget relate to the median? And, you know, how far is it within the bell curve of the median? Because you want to stay in the bell curve because that's where most people can afford to buy. So let's say 20, 30% either side of the median, that's where there's going to be the greatest demand because it's where most people can afford to buy or rent.
Great tip. Now I'm going to, that segues us into our second point, what is the micro location suburb? And back to the journey I'm helping a couple on, they were considering all kinds of ideas that had been put in their head, probably by barbecue chat or wherever they were able to glean their information. And they were asking me about bargain buys, you know, really affordable suburbs in locations that most people hadn't heard of. So it might be 4 hours from a capital city, a little township with a low population count. And that introduces a lot of risk when you do something like that. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but the risk is pretty high. So when you're looking at micro locations and suburbs, back to your point, Dave, staying closer to the median value is pretty important, because if you're going for, you know, the lowest quartile or the lowest decile, you are introducing all kinds of risks.
Absolutely. One of the steps we would then come to now is, okay, what sort of dwelling type would you like to target? You know, in an ideal world, certainly the evidence is stacking up that a standalone dwelling on its own title is outperforming units, for example. And that's sort of backing up over many years now. So I think in an ideal world, you want to see if you can target a standalone dwelling. Now, you may not be able to because of when you then circle back towards the macro location you've selected and your budget. And so then if you work through the list of the types of properties, well, does that mean you then need to come down one level to maybe a semi-detached property, or then down, let's say, to a townhouse, or then move down to maybe a villa unit? But working through the dwelling type that you'd like to target and how that aligns with your budget within the macro location, and then intersecting that with the micro location, the suburb or regional town, it's a vital process to go through. And it's a bit like, you know, sifting for the gold and getting rid of the grains of sand in your pan. There's no perfect answer to going about this, but it is a critical part of the process. And you might go back and forth between suburb, dwelling type, seeing what lines up with your price point. And you need to have really good access to recent comparable sales to do that. But working through that process is a critical step. And it's one where it is one where a lot of buyers bounce around and get stuck.
They do.
Because there isn't a black and white answer to that.
I think, well, I'm going to gently disagree. I think the black and white component to this that can help a lot of people is focusing on the cash flow. So if this is an investment decision and you're wondering what sort of dwelling type you should be considering, you need to understand what sort of cash flow you've got at your fingertips. And cash flow is a direct reflection of your holding costs for the property and what sort of rental income you can anticipate. So first and foremost, I always target areas for investment that have tight vacancy rates. We don't want huge vacancy rates because getting a tenant is really important. If you can't get a tenant, you're introducing vacancy, then you're going to whittle away your yield. So if you've got a tight vacancy rate area and you know what the standard rental yield offering is for houses in that location and for units, you can get that info out of a CoreLogic report pretty easily. When it comes to the detail, though, units is a very broad classification. And you can look at apartments that are yielding particularly high. You can look at townhouses that are delivering a really good rental return because they've got lots of bells and whistles and a huge internal floor space. There's lots of different types of units. And chatting to a property manager can be really helpful. So that is one tip. If you're calculating your holding costs, you absolutely need to know what sort of rent you can anticipate. And to your point, Dave, houses have outperformed units, broadly speaking, but sometimes you need to go for a unit in order to meet your cash flow needs. And Pete,
exactly.
I want to bring you into this because you've developed, you've been an investor yourself, and I know that you're all over this. I don't necessarily subscribe to house on land is the only option. I think we need to be prepared to look at all shades of grey when we're considering a balanced investment portfolio.
Yeah, so certainly the older style units and apartments could be looked at, especially for those people with cash flow. But let's have a look at the capital growth. So again, I go back to my 10 years worth of forecasting. So what I did was I picked 20 suburbs that I thought would do better than the average in that particular capital city, and I looked at houses and unit growth. I'm not going to go through all 107 suburbs, but I think you'll pick a theme very, very, very quickly. So in Melbourne, Geelong, houses went up 89.5% in that 10-year period. Units went backwards 0.9%. Abbotsford, 94% increase for houses. Units, 17%. Braybrook, 149% increase for houses, only 80% for units. Brunswick, 113% for houses and 28% for units. If I go to Sydney, I'm not cherry-picking here. I'm just going down my list. Arncliffe, 146% up for houses, 149% for units. All right, so in Arncliffe, units outperformed houses by a little bit. In Ashfield, 128% up for houses, 102% for units. And the story is the same for every capital city. If it's capital growth you are looking for, then in my opinion, you are far better off looking for houses or minimum townhouses that have some sort of land component. And I hope that answers directly that listener question. What are some of the lessons that I've learnt in life? For capital growth, houses are generally better than units.
Really good tip.
I agree. The evidence is really strong. And just on your point, Kate, I agree. Like often the independent umpire, if you like, to decide what's right for you is the yield and what works for your cash flow. And that might be the final part of what will determine whether you get a townhouse, for example, versus a standalone house, because the townhouse you might be able to get in a closer location, and because of your cash flow restrictions, it might mean you get a slightly higher rental yield. And also, it's not as black and white as a standalone dwelling being in a further out suburb being better than a townhouse in a closer in suburb, for example.
Yes. Yeah, you know, they're apples and oranges, aren't they?
Yeah, so I just want to make that really clear. But if you're looking at, you know, here's the ideal suburb and you can get a house via townhouse, then the evidence tells us over a long period of time that the house is probably going to outperform. So if you're looking in the same location, then you can go higher up the property type stack, if you like. The highest point on the property stack is a standalone house.
Can I throw in my 2 cents worth?
Yeah.
Because I don't want to argue with Kate because she is one of my favourite people in the world, but I do want to make this statement.
Why don't you ever say that about me, Pete?
Second five.
And this is a question for all of our listeners maybe to discuss over the next week. Does yield matter that much when interest rates are so low? Because most of you will not be negatively geared.
Yield absolutely matters depending on your strategy. If your strategy is buy and hold and enjoy your retirement income directly from your rents. It doesn't matter how much your property is growing in value if your plan is not to sell it. You can't just get an equity loan and live off equity. Banks don't like that as a retirement plan. If your retirement plan is based on the properties that you hold and you don't want to sell any of them, you need rent. And it's little use to have a property yielding 1.5% rent and growing it at a crazy pace if you don't want to sell it. If you want to sell it, great. You sell it, you pay your CGT, you put your money in shares and you get your dividends. But if you're looking for rental income to live off, yield absolutely matters.
Yeah, you're 100% correct. My strategy is a little bit different, and it doesn't mean that mine's right or wrong, but I'm closer to retirement than not. So my strategy is to sell some.
Yeah.
I'll still have a mortgage when I retire, but that's okay because the rent coming in will more than cover the mortgage. But for me, one of the issues that I have, I've got four kids, so my kids probably expect some property. So it's not I can leave one property. I either have to leave four or I have to leave eight or I have to leave 12. Mate, it takes a lot of work to pay off four or eight or 12 properties.
What a divisible.
So hopefully the kids will be left with enough, but also I don't have to, you know, keep working to pay off all those mortgages because all I need to do, if we're talking very rough numbers, sell half the portfolio to pay off the mortgages on the other half and then you're done. That's just my strategy. You know, that's not for everyone. But what you said, Kate, is 100% correct.
Yeah. So
neither you or I are right or wrong, or Dave, it's just that we have different perspectives.
Well, but this is the thing, and this is my point most of the time, is there's shades of grey.
Yeah.
Okay, so Kate makes that point. But are you going to be tapping into that equity? Because there is value to having a greater value growing asset that you can then tap into the equity more often and more easily to buy other assets.
But what for? Like, at what stage is enough? I guess that's my question.
Well, it's different for everybody. So, again, another shade of grey.
Yeah.
So this is my point.
Can I ask the mortgage broker a question, Dave? If you want to build your portfolio, what's more important, the cash flow or the equity? If you had to pick one.
I would say equity.
Yeah, okay. Every day.
So then that sort of flips it around. So that's the point, I think, is there's these shades of grey.
Yeah.
And you're overlaying a different budget with a different human being set of goals, you know, with different locations. So, you know, I just think, you know, we need to be careful saying black and white answers, even though often that's what people want to hear, because everyone's situation and circumstance is different. And, you know, there isn't black and white answers to property because the financial outcome is driven by human behaviour.
Yeah.
And human behaviour into the future isn't black and white. So you've got to have a way of working through and navigating the decision-making. And, you know, certainly sometimes with this discussion of a bit further out for a standalone dwelling to a bit further in, and I'm oversimplifying, to get a townhouse, you might go, okay, well, I'm going to go, the decision for me is because the rent's higher on the townhouse, that might be the right decision for person A, but it may not be for person B.
I think the black and white comment is about your cash flow. Now, cash flow is black and white because we know what we can deal with. And when people get it wrong, it's when they've bitten off more than they can chew or when they've been too conservative. And understanding your cash flow and how much you're prepared to put towards holding your property portfolio is really critical because you've got to commit to that and it's a long-term commitment. And cash flow changes too, we all know that. You can get a pay rise or change jobs or something can happen in your life that dramatically changes your cash flow. But I think that's the part that we need to always recognise and be all right across so that we can make the right decisions.
And that's why we worked our way through this process with last week's episode and, you know, covered off on understanding your money goals and what you want your surplus cash flow to look like is one of the key money goals that we work with every client on to determine the price point. And obviously that is factoring in the estimated yield as well. So I couldn't agree more, Kate. It's vital. It should be determining your price point, and also it is why the yield is so important as well.
A very important answer is implied there for our listener. What lessons have we learned? Hopefully one lesson you've learned from that discussion that we just had is people need to go and get qualified property investment advice because everybody's property investment journey is different, mainly because you have different goals and you have different circumstances. So it's find us to listen to the experts, to listen to podcasts, to get some general information. But when it comes to creating your wealth and safekeeping your retirement or your income, you know, put your hand in your pocket, pay a professional to get some decent advice.
Oh, nice.
Great advice, Pete.
Now, we've got one little fragment of this left, and it's one that I threw in. It was about tactics and on-the-ground tactics. So once you're out there inspecting, talking to agents, that kind of thing, and we haven't got very much time left. So I've just circled in on a couple because I do have some tips, and I know you will too, Pete, because you're very active on the ground and you're chatting to the agents all the time. So one of my tips when I'm seeing a property is how I get information from the agent, because we can source information, we can research, but sometimes the agent can give you some really good information very quickly and effortlessly because it's their market and it's all of their market knowledge associated with that property. And it's just about asking the right way. So if I'm particularly keen on a property, that's when I'll circle in and start asking the agent questions, not before I've made a decision about whether the property is one that I'm interested in or not. Because if we ask the agents for lots of information as we walk through every front door, they'll get sick of us being nosy. But once we're really familiar with the property and we know that we want to have a crack at buying it, that's when we ask lots of questions. And sometimes the agents will give you their comparable sales, even the comparable sales that are in their head. So they can help you with your pricing research if you're asking the right questions. You're not saying to the agent, what do I need to spend on this property? You're talking about how some properties compare to this property. Pete, what are some of your tips when meeting the agents and getting a bit of intel?
So, Kate, you are the tactic queen because you do this on a daily basis, but I'll admit I'm not very good when it comes to tactics. I'm pretty good when it comes to research and analysis. But one thing I do have is good working relationships with local real estate agents. So I know I can ring someone and they'll tell me the truth. I mean, I don't expect them to tell me something that they shouldn't because they're obviously working for the vendor. But especially if I'm looking for general information about a property that they may not be selling, but they heard about what happened, why it sold for so much or why it sold for so little, I think developing good working relationships with agents in the areas you're interested in buying in is really important. That doesn't mean you take them out to dinner and stuff like that, but when you speak to them, speak nicely, for example. Don't harass them, you know, ring them every week. And ask them sensible questions. You know, there are some things, you know, stupid questions will soon put people off. Don't harass them. Ask them sensible questions. And I found for me that's worked really well because then I can get intel that is really not out there in the public domain. It's not that I paid somebody and did something underhanded, but I just knew where to go to get the information. So if there is one thing that I've learnt about tactics, is develop good working relationships with local agents.
Great tip.
100% agree, Pete. And I think once you've decided on your dwelling type and your location, call the local agents. Let them know you're serious about buying, the type of asset you're targeting, what your price range is, maybe with a little bit of room to move. Don't share your upper limit with them, but so they're going to be likely to give you a phone call as soon as a property comes up that is within your scope.
Except for 2021.
They are
so busy. You know, properties are selling themselves. And
it depends where you are. But certainly inner suburbs of Melbourne, it's probably less likely.
Everywhere at the moment. We're in a seller's market across the nation. And agents, even when they're wanting to be in helpful mode.
Oh, there's some small towns that don't have a lot of people buying property and the agents will call serious buyers.
But the people are leaving the capital cities and going to the country towns.
I think we misunderstand. If a property is likely to sell itself within days of being listed, the impetus for the agent to reach out to buyers is reasonably limited, maybe with off-markets and pre-markets. But what we do need to do is make sure that we're the memorable buyer for all of the right reasons so the agents know we're serious. And maybe when you go through a property, if it's not for you, don't be afraid to have a conversation with the agent about that. Not in front of other people. You've got to do it sensitively. But if they ask you as you're leaving, what do you think of this one? You can say, look, it's not for me, but I'm happy to have a chat with you. They might call you and invest a little bit of time in that phone call. Let them know what doesn't work for you with that property because they'll be able to suggest others that are perhaps coming on. And yeah, to your point, Dave, I think being prepared to let them know that you're a serious buyer and give them an idea of your price range. With it. You don't even have to say a number. You can just say, look, this prior sale, right place, right time would have been something that I would have potential interest in. That already tells the agent that you've got the right dollars.
If you fail to plan, you plan to fail. Sit down with a friend or your spouse and brainstorm questions you'd like to ask agents when you're serious on a property. Type them out, write them down, know what they are. So then you're not nervous, you know, you're not having to think of the questions on the spot. You have a plan for the questions you're going to ask and they're pretty consistent. So you can do it confidently because so many people actually, you know, have some anxiety about the communications with the agent. And if you have that anxiety, you're probably more likely when we have anxiety to not communicate as well as we would have liked. So, you know, just preparing and having a plan for each key action in the process of buying a property, you can buy a quality property with success for yourself.
Yeah, great point. Now, my last little tactic tip is leaning on a different kind of agent, not a selling agent, a managing agent. And Pete, I know you're familiar with this and you've got a very trusted property manager over in Adelaide. I don't think I can emphasise enough the value in a good conversation with a great property manager, and particularly at the planning phase. And this is very relevant if you're going into a city that you're a little bit unfamiliar with, whether it's a local region or whether it's interstate. If you can get a referral or find someone who is knowledgeable and passionate about property management, they can give you so much information about the right properties to target. Because as investors, we often think about capital growth and we forget sometimes about what will draw a tenant and keep a tenant and what will attract the best type of tenant and what sorts of tenants are in town and what do they like, what do they value in a property, because the attributes that we value won't necessarily be the same attributes in a very different city or township. Pete, can I ask you to share how you go about chatting to a property manager before you sign a purchase contract?
Again, I like to find a local property manager. I mean, my property manager is absolutely terrific and they manage properties all over Adelaide, but I often will focus on property managers that just work on a few suburbs because they have really deep knowledge of the local area. And I want to know what sort of tenant am I likely to get. So we're talking white collar professionals, we're talking families, we're talking single people. What sort of rent am I likely to get? And how often am I going to have to be renewing my lease? Are most people going to be here for 1 year maximum, or families tend to stay longer? It's that sort of information that helps me formulate a decision as to whether I buy that particular rental property or not.
And at the same time, you're going to be sussing out who's your preferred property manager for the location, as well as getting some great intel. And there's just another layer of subjectivity that goes into selecting the location and the property type that you're going to select.
Well, we've navigated a few tips and tricks there, and I'm sure there are so many more that we could share, but thank you very much for that listener question. We've loved addressing it. Now, to wrap up, I'm going to ask you both to put your thinking caps on and come up with a gold nugget.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
Dave.
So once you've determined your asset type and your suburb, you then need to decide the pockets and A-grade streets that you're going to target within that suburb. Now that isn't as difficult as it sounds. So starting tip would be look on the map and look at those streets or pockets that appear to have one-way streets and are within, let's say, about 1.5 kilometres to the key attributes of the suburb. Now you need to work out what are the key attributes of the suburb as well. Some attributes in some suburbs will be more important than others, but you know, you're looking at the shopping strip, you're looking at the local schools, you're looking at parkland, river, ocean, lake. Where is there a higher altitude? Where might there be properties with views? So go through that process and you'll actually end up being able to narrow down to the key, you know, to the best one or two pockets and the best streets in any given suburb. And the process isn't as difficult as it sounds. And, you know, you also definitely should walk around those streets, have a coffee, have lunch there, But that is your final step, really. And then once you know where the A-grade streets are that you're going to target, then you just need to wait till properties come up for sale and, yeah, put your best foot forward.
Nicely said, Pete.
Yeah, so I'm going to refer back to one of our previous episodes, which was the seven S's of property investment. So we're looking starting top, going down. Pick your state, pick your city. I know that doesn't start with an S, but it's got an S sound. So pick your city or town. Pick your suburb, pick your street, pick the style of property you want to buy. Kate and I are very much into character period style homes, but pick your style of property, size of the property. You want 2-bedroom, 3-bedroom, 4-bedroom, and soil, which really is land. I couldn't think of a better synonym, so I'm using soil for land. Ideally, you want to be buying something which has a land component, whether it's a house, whether it's a townhouse, something with land. So check it out. The seven S's of property investment.
With 10 seconds to spare. Well done. I look forward to seeing you guys next week.
Thank you very much. See you next week. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about selecting a location for investment, you can listen to the following episodes as well. Episode 8, Interpreting Data to Uncover an Outstanding Property and Location and How to Sort the Gold from the Lies, Damn Lies and Statistics. Episode 14, How to Choose a Location for Investment, What to Look for and What to Avoid. Episode 21, Why Price Points Should Determine Location and Strategy. And also Episode 36, Buying the Wrong Property and or in the Wrong Location, which is number 6 of the 7 critical mistakes. Thank you.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bakos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.